Rest in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. A good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Glad to be back. And yes, we do have 2 hours to talk about the things that matter most. Matthew Bunsen joining me today, taking a look at the remarkable transformation of the late Robert Schuller's Crystal Cathedral in Orange County, California. Among evangelical Protestants, Schuller's innovation of creating a church for people who could kind of drive in and actually listen to the sermon from outside. They didn't even have to enter. And then Schuller eventually going to build this crystal cathedral, very controversial among conservative Protestants. But when he went bankrupt and his ministry went bankrupt, he needed somebody to kind of carry on at least the property, and he wanted somebody who would carry it on dedicated to Christ, and he had always had great respect for Archbishop Fulton Sheen, and so he ended up ensuring that the Catholic Church would be able to get the property, and they have turned this in now, as of July 17th, a dedicated Catholic cathedral. We'll talk to Matthew about it. We'll also take a look at the latest news on the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris. We're also going to spend time with Anthony Bradley on the problem of over-incarceration. You often hear it said that the United States incarcerates a larger percentage of its population than North Korea or South Africa. Well, that's not quite true, but we're going to find out what the problem is, because we do have an incredible percentage of our population incarcerated. We're also going to talk with Father Carter Griffin about celibacy. He's written an outstanding defense of celibacy. That's coming up. But first, the headlines.
Thanks, Hal. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, July 18th. It's the feast of St. Camillus of Lillis. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. President Trump says a U.S. Navy warship shot down an Iranian drone in the Strait of Hormuz.
Ignoring multiple calls to stand down and was threatening the safety of the ship and the ship's crew, the drone was immediately destroyed.
Speaking from the White House, Trump added tensions have been running high in the Persian Gulf. Weeks ago, Iran shot down a U.S. drone, and the British seized an Iranian tanker for violating terms of the Iran nuclear deal. Registered sex offender and wealthy financier Jeffrey Epstein will remain behind bars while he waits trial on new charges in New York City. Attorney Sigrid McCauley represents one of the women who have accused Epstein, and she calls it a victory that he was denied bail.
Only by taking away the freedom of Jeffrey Epstein can we restore the freedom of these victims. They have been living in fear and intimidation since the day they were abused by him, and now he is in jail.
A judge agreed with prosecutors that given Epstein's wealth, access to private jets, and frequent international travel, he was a flight risk. Investigators say they found $70,000 in cash, piles of diamonds, and a fake passport at the billionaire's home, which is where his attorneys had lobbied for house arrest. Southwest Airlines is extending cancellations of its Boeing 737 MAX flights even further. The airline says it will not fly its 737 MAX models until at least November or perhaps longer. This follows similar schedule changes announced by American and United Airlines. It will mean cancellations of about 180 flights a day out of about 4,000 Southwest flights. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thank you for joining me. There's no doubt that the sexual abuse crisis, whether we're talking about criminal behavior or if we're talking about behavior between even consenting adults, one of those adults is a priest, we have a problem. And, of course, since the Boston Globe breaking of the story in 2002, and then, of course, last year's revelation of former Cardinal McCarrick's behavior, the question of sexual misconduct on the part of Catholic clergy comes up everywhere. In fact, I was just at a family reunion about a week and a half ago now, and that was the one question that came up about the Catholic faith. Thankfully, we were able to pivot from that onto some more edifying topics. But these were non-Catholics raising the question. So I know it's out there. What should we say? How should we understand celibacy? Again, the watching world tends to link the promise of chaste celibacy with the failure of priests being able to live up to it. We're going to talk about this and many other things with Father Carter Griffin, who's given us the great service of writing a book which takes very seriously the questions underlying celibacy. It's called Why Celibacy? Reclaiming the Fatherhood of the Priest. And Father Griffin is Vocations Director and Vice Rector of the Blessed John Paul II Seminary. Well, Father, it's good to have you here. Thank you.
Thanks, Al. It's great to be here.
Let's just go to decoupling the celibacy issue from the current news. It never struck me that celibacy was at the heart, or the promise of chaste celibacy was at the heart of this issue, simply because we were talking about the kind of sexual behaviors which can be carried out even by married men, pedophilia, sex with minor children who are post-pubescent. That goes on even with within families where there are married people. So it never struck me that a man who was having difficulty keeping his promise of chaste celibacy, that would drive him to all of a sudden begin looking at minor children. So why don't we disconnect the celibacy issue from this problem? Where do you like to begin decoupling it?
Well, you know, I would say a couple of things.
You know,
I would say, first of all, you know, when we talk about the evil of infidelity, of sexual misconduct, as you called it earlier, which is so accurate, is we're talking about something that unfortunately afflicts, you know, the entire human race.
Right.
It's something that we see this in every culture, we see this in every denomination, we see this in every religion. You know, that this is part of, you know, this is one of the great evils of the fallen world that we have to constantly be fighting. You know, people who are unfaithful, who are hurting young people, who are hurting children, and not being faithful to the promises that they've made to their spouses or to God.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's an important place to say, let's call it what it is, you know. And because once we do that, then we realize that infidelity is something that obviously afflicts, you know, other vocations
right.
too.
Right.
You know, unfortunately, the most sexual abuse, you know, happens by, you know, people who are married. And, you know, I talk about like, celibacy causes, you know, sexual misconduct, you know, or abuse of children in the same way that marriage causes adultery, you know, which is to say it doesn't, you know, but it's associated in people's mind. And if, of course, if there's no marriage, then there's no adultery, but that doesn't mean there shouldn't be marriage, you know, and celibacy is, so I think that would be one thing, that's sort of the negative kind of response. But then the other half of it, which I think is hopefully what the book tries to do, which is a much more positive, well, why do we have celibacy mm-hmm. to begin with? What are some of its great blessings? You know, mm-hmm. so that's what I try to look at.
So would you then begin the discussion of celibacy with the whole idea of priesthood and spiritual paternity?
I think so. You know, I mean, I'm looking specifically at priestly celibacy. I think a lot of what I say also applies to religious men and women, as well as much of it applies to lay people who, for whatever reason, do not get married but are still called to give life,
and
above all, spiritual life, supernatural life. By you know, in the order of grace, by cooperating with God's grace in that way. So I think there's an awful lot which kind of goes across the board. But I, you know, for the sake of the situation today and my own knowledge and expertise, I sort of focus more on priestly celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
But what I tried to do is just say that, you know, look, what is this idea? I mean, God gives life, you know, and when He made Adam and Eve, He made them and he invited them into His own capacity to create, you know, and he meant that primarily sort of biologically and naturally, obviously, to begin with. but that those children that they were going to have would have immortal souls like they, and those immortal souls would last for, would live forever, you know, and it was part of their function, part of their role, part of their vocation was to help their children go to heaven. And that has been true all the way through the centuries, you know, that we have this not only biological and natural fatherhood and motherhood, but also supernatural, you know, giving life. And what a priest, what a celibate priest is doing is he's trying to live his life in such a way that he's living, in a sense, that third and highest degree of fatherhood, you know, that he spends his life with, you know, by offering the sacraments and by preaching and by teaching, by protecting his, you know, those entrusted to his care and spiritually and otherwise, that he does all these things that a father does, but he does it in the order of grace, you know, and that is a very, I think, a very beautiful, very positive and very true understanding of celibacy, which has helped me a lot, and those that experience celibacy in that way, it's a source of tremendous joy for us to live that way.
Among your brother priests, is there a large amount of dissatisfaction with the rule of celibacy?
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm rector of a small college seminary, St. John Paul II Seminary in Washington, and we have about 50 guys here. We've been open 8 years. We've been full every year we've been open.
Nice.
And these young guys are generally in their, you know, low 20s or, upper, you know, say between 19 and 21 might be the average age here.
Okay.
And we've had 141 or two men go through these halls. I can't actually name one who would get rid of the church's, you know, discipline.
Yeah.
Younger priests, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they're out there.
Right,
but
right.
I know the statistics are dramatically in favor of, especially younger priests, supporting. They find it a very beautiful way of living out their priesthood, and a very life-giving way. And most priests, as we know from studies, have a far higher, you know, level of sort of professional happiness, if
yeah.
you will, than their peers, and are just, you know, the vast majority of priests are faithful, happy, committed men.
Yeah,
you know, and we can't let, you know, the headlines, dramatic and awful as they are, to allow us to forget that.
It's an important point because the headlines distort. And I think
yeah.
we've always got to keep in mind that what constitutes news in terms of the commercial news media world, what constitutes news is whatever will arrest your attention.
Sure.
And bad news arrests people's attention better than good news. I mean, that's just generally the rule of the industry. So we're going to get a distorted picture of reality if we really think the commercial news media is keeping us properly informed and balanced. Why did celibacy develop? How does it, is it something that is an institutional creation, or does it grow out of the nature of the priesthood?
Well, it's a great question, because one of the points that I try to make to folks is you know, who are believers, who, you know,
yeah.
who have an understanding of the priesthood that we do, which is that there's actually only one priest in the new covenant.
That
you know,
is right.
It's Jesus Christ.
Yep.
You know, and we all, as Christians baptized, share in that in one way, as ministerial priests in a slightly different way, but in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one priest, you know, and that one priest is celibate. And that celibacy was not just kind of a fluke of circumstance, or the fact that he couldn't find a wife, or the fact that he needed more time to want, you know, to preach and to heal.
Right, right.
It was something very deeply. His heart was completely open, and it was widened to all the people that he needed to serve in his sojourn on earth, in his ministry on earth. And that hasn't changed. You know, his heart is still completely open. His sacred heart is open to souls, and whoever needs him, we always have access to our great high priest. And it doesn't mean that it's impossible to have married priests. Obviously, we have married priests, and I know many of them, and they're wonderful holy men. But there is something uniquely suitable and apt about, which sometimes, by the way, those married priests and their wives are the first, are the biggest cheerleaders.
Yeah.
They say, yeah, this is difficult. There's something uniquely apt about having a man who is not committed in that particular and very beautiful way in marriage to a family. And his heart is wide open to the people that he serves. You know, when I was, I'm a convert myself. And when I grew up, I remember going to pastors, our Protestant pastors,
mm-hmm.
good men, all of them. But I knew, I obviously had to work around his family, you know? I mean, I didn't come first.
That's right.
And I shouldn't have come first.
That's right.
In his life. Right. You know, and recognizing that anyone who comes to me as a celibate Catholic priest, frankly, I'm there for them. You know, there's no one kind of in the wings who's got first priority in my heart.
Yeah.
You know.
No, I served as a pastor for 5 years in an independent evangelical church, and you're absolutely right. It was never any doubt in my mind that my first obligation was to my wife and children.
Right.
And in fact, the congregation wanted to assume that my wife was going to somehow be the associate pastor.
She was, but
yes, but I had to set them straight.
Right.
But I think this is real important. I mean, if I understand you correctly, then there's a way in which the celibate priest is able to exercise more of fatherhood because he exercises it more in keeping with what we see God the Father do and what we see God the Son do.
I mean, I think in a certain sense that's correct. You know, that the highest degree of fatherhood is supernatural fatherhood,
right.
And every man is called to that, and a priest does so in a very unique and very powerful way.
Yeah.
I would say, if we were to sort of quibble philosophically, there's a sense in which producing a child, a natural child, a biological child, has a kind of closer analogy to the generation of the eternal Son, you know,
mm-hmm,
that there's kind of a generation of a like nature, you know.
Yes, yes, okay.
That's kind of splitting. But so there, the point is that the beauty of God's fatherhood is diffused, you know, and it's diffused, and it's given this great privilege that we have as men and as women to share in that in a particular way, and priests do so just as much or perhaps more in some ways than a married man does.
Mm-hmm. When does the discipline of celibacy, how does it grow? What's the history of it? How does it grow up?
Oh, yeah, thank you. I guess I started with that to say that, you know, when Jesus spoke about some following him in this particular way, you know, that they would become eunuchs for the sake of the
right.
kingdom of heaven
mm-hmm.
in Matthew's gospel, that we know that he wasn't saying this to everyone, but he was clearly identifying this as an important part of the church's life. And the church early on, it did not immediately associate that exclusively or only or primarily with the priesthood, although we know St. Paul, of course, a Catholic priest, he was celibate. John the Baptist was a sort of forerunner to Christ
mm-hmm,
as celibate.
Mm-hmm.
There were many celibate men. There, you know, perhaps St. John the Beloved.
Right.
And then, you know, in the early centuries of the church, already you began to see this. So there is an organic development which had certain moments of punctuation. You know, often people will say it was invented by the institution in the 11th century or something like
right,
that.
Right, right, right.
When it was really just it was a way of protecting something that had existed for a long time and to protect the beauty of something, you know, over time. So there was an institutional sort of protection and development over time,
right.
But organically it comes, I think, from Jesus himself. Yeah.
Father, hold it till we'll come back on the other side of the break. My guest, Father Carter Griffin, the book, Why Celibacy? Reclaiming the Fatherhood of the Priest.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
Not everyone who's attracted to the Lord and to a life of service is necessarily meant to be a priest. So there's all kinds of forms. I mean, from, let's say, the brotherhood, if you want to stay within a formal religious context, but then all kinds of ministries within a parish, all kinds of lay ministries that you can do. So not everyone's called to the priesthood. A priest is someone who is dedicated, devoted to ongoing study and ongoing prayer, to be a spiritual father. As Pope Benedict said, one of his wisest remarks, he said, people want many things from a priest, but what they want above all is someone who's a master of the spiritual life. Hey, I'm great at this ministry, and hey, I'm great at organizing this meeting, and hey, I'm great. Fine, but ultimately what the people want is you're a master of the spiritual life. You got to be, therefore, trained in prayer and theology and spirituality and so on.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Why should we do no work on the Sabbath as the third commandment demands? The Catholic Catechism reminds us that in 6 days the Lord God made the heavens and the earth and the seas and all that is in them. On the seventh day he rested, thereby blessing and hallowing the Sabbath. The Sabbath is also a memorial of Israel's liberation from Egypt. The Sabbath is a sign of God's irrevocable covenant with Israel. Thus, the day is to be set apart as holy and for the praise of God, his work of creation, and his saving action on behalf of Israel. God set a model for human action. If the Almighty Creator could take a day off for rest and refreshment, so should his creatures. For Christians, Sunday replaces Sabbath observance because it is the day Jesus rose from the dead and ushered in the new creation. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
I would always hear from different people at non-Catholic churches that Catholics were going to hell or that they really didn't know who the Lord was. The Catholic Church is not all what people say it is. I mean, it's completely different. There's so many stereotypes. It's very possible to know the Lord, and it's very possible to have a relationship with God in the Catholic Church. I believe I was born into the Catholic Church, and that's where I belong.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs in community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Ciao, Sorelli and Fratelli, sisters and brothers. Teresa Tomeo here from Catholic Connection. Through the years, so many of you have contacted me asking for my advice on traveling to my favorite place in the world, Italy. Being that I've had the blessing of visiting the country more than 50 times now, I've decided to respond to those special requests by introducing Tease Italy at TravelItalyExpert.com, a website for all things Italia where you'll receive insider tips on where to eat, stay, shop, play, and most importantly, pray. At TravelItalyExpert.com, you'll discover, with the help of our key partners, Ave Maria Radio and Corporate Travel, this beautiful Catholic country through videos, blogs, and even personal travel consulting. So whether you're planning that upcoming visit or just want to learn more about Italy, connect with me on TravelItalyExpert.com. Ciao for now. We'll see you online at Tease Italy, TravelItalyExpert.com.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Father Carter Griffin, author of Why Celibacy? Reclaiming the Fatherhood of the Priest. We were talking before the break about the development of the discipline of celibacy. There's an organic growth that begins very early on. I mean, you see St. John the Baptist, for heaven's sakes, even before the establishing of the new covenant, is celibate. You have certainly Jesus. You have St. Paul. Non-Catholics like to point out that Peter was married. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would say, you know, he was married. We don't know if he was still married at the time. His wife may have died, and that's true for the other disciples too. But I think there's no reason why we would need to suggest that all apostles and all bishops after them, you know, were unmarried, which is simply not the case.
Right.
So Peter may well have been married. But what many scholars are starting to realize is that it seems as if, even if there were married clergy, that going way back, perhaps even apostolic times, there was an understanding that they would remain continent. That is to say, that they wouldn't engage in marital intercourse. And that may well have been the case. We don't have definitive, you know, proof of that. But the point is that as soon as we start seeing this in the 200s, 300s, you know, it seems as if this is already a very ancient practice, this understanding that the priests especially would not approach the sacred liturgy while having had sexual relations with their wives. And so that practice seems to go very early on in the church. And who knows? You know, we just don't know the precise answer to that,
right,
to that question,
right,
about St. Peter.
You've made the case in the book that celibacy offers many incredible benefits. We've mentioned one in particular, and that is freedom to really, in a sense, be married to the congregation one is serving. What are some of the other benefits?
You know, I think that one of the a very important need today, and we live in this kind of post, in the wake of the sexual revolution and all the damage that it's done to individuals, to families, and to society. And what a celibate man does by just his existence when he's faithful, and this is one of the great dramatic failures one of the repercussions of this clergy sexual abuse crisis, is that for many people, their understanding of the celibate priest is that it's a man who's unfaithful. You know, but when celibacy is lived well, as it is in most cases, you know, then we are able to show people that there is a way of living without sexual relations which is still full of meaning and joy and purpose. And people need to know that we're not sort of victims of our own sexual urges, and that there are so many dimensions of life other than what society is telling us is the pinnacle of human life, which is sexual activity. And we're able to say that's just not true. And moreover, not only is it not true, but it actually stunts your capacity to really receive so many other blessings in life and joys in life by allowing that to become your sole focus. Yeah. So I think that's a very important lesson that celibacy teaches. And I think to show that it can be done, you know, that there are natural and supernatural means of living chastity that everyone needs to have, including married people. You know,
right.
That they're
absolutely
the idea of sort of unleashed, you know, sexual license is not good for anybody.
No, that's true. Yeah.
You know, so I think those are some of the many things that celibacy hopefully can instill.
You know there's an irony here which just struck me, and that is one of the slogans of the second wave feminist movement was that biology is not our destiny.
Yeah.
And that's actually what the celibate priesthood demonstrates. Biology is not your destiny. You're not victim of your sexual compulsions or urges.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think as well, you know, there's a witness to what we were mentioning earlier, that married people as well and unmarried people are also called to this way of kind of uniquely giving life. And when you're walking around, and actually at a deeper level, just kind of the existence of God, you know, that when you walk around, you know, in a Roman collar or you're a religious sister or something like that, you're kind of a walking contradiction to many of the assumptions of the modern world.
That's right.
And it's one of the reasons why, by the way, people who don't share our Catholic faith, let alone our Christian faith, you know, are so interested in priestly celibacy. Sometimes I just want to say, like, why do you care? and I mean, they're not, you know,
right.
but they care because they realize deep down, whether they've been able to articulate it or not, that there is something very powerful about celibacy, which is either right or wrong. And if celibacy is right, then a lot of what they're assuming about sex and about happiness in life is wrong.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. When the church looks at the sources for celibacy, does it go to the example of Jesus then and the example of St. Paul? Are those the primary sources?
Certainly those would be the original sources, the initial sources, you know, 1 Corinthians and, you know, Matthew's Gospel and some of these other sources from the Scriptures, but then also some very ancient documents. There's some ancient synods that were held, and there's one in the 300s in Spain, which already identifies it as a very ancient practice, or it seems to assume that it's a very ancient practice. But also, you know, just after the time of the martyrs, many in the church started to see celibacy as like the heroic witness of that day.
Yes,
you know?
Okay.
And so there was a sense in which this is, you know, Anthony in the desert and stuff like that, you know, where you started to have these experiences of men and women going off and living in this way, in a very explicit way, you know, celibacy. But even they, again, it didn't seem like that was a novelty with them, you know, that these were things that had been done already for centuries.
Right, right.
And then it just grows over time, you know, and then people will often focus on the canonical question of it. And that, of course, emerged much later.
Let's talk, if you don't mind, what can be some of the distortions of celibacy, some of the negatives that accompany it? Does it, every state in life has its downside as well. What are some of the pitfalls of celibacy?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that celibates have, and Pope Francis has spoken about this, that married people and celibate people each have something to teach the other, you know, even when they're faithful. And married people can do a lot to teach celibates about not becoming sort of closed in on themselves or kind of cold or almost like a bachelor kind of mentality. You know, that a celibate priest is not a bachelor.
Yeah.
And really, a single Christian man shouldn't be a bachelor.
That's right.
If by bachelor we mean kind of, you know, the sort of the hypochondriatic guy who lives for himself and, you know, sort of fixated on his own pleasures and stuff like that. So that sense of kind of having a comfortable life that, you know, I think is something that married people can teach us, and that can be a danger of celibacy. We can give in to that sort of that attitude. I think another one would be, you know, celibacy does free us, both practically in terms of time, but also in terms of emotional and psychological availability to serve. But that can also lead to a kind of workaholism, you know, or kind of almost a freneticism in our life. We just become so busy and so full of stuff to do, even good stuff to do for the Lord, that it becomes kind of unhealthy. You know, I think that can actually creep in sometimes.
Yeah.
And then there can be a kind of, if somebody is not much, but this happens in marriage too, but if somebody is not mature, humanly kind of confident in who they are, and, you know, that it can start, you know, there's a natural corrective in marriage, you know, for a man who's married, and that natural corrective is called his wife.
That's true. Very true. You test another reality tester, yes.
Right. Another human being who can sort of, you know, and has the authority and kind of the access to say, hey, quit doing that. You know, that's weird. You mm-hmm. know? And a priest doesn't have that if he doesn't sort of put that into his life, you know, to have people who around him who can kind of correct him in big things, but also in kind of small, you know, small things.
In conversation with some friends of mine who are, in fact, priests and who I think are wonderful priests, they have pointed out that the current problem we face, one problem we face, is that priests are often alone in a parish. They don't they don't have a sense of peer community that they're, you know, a part of. They don't bump up against one another often enough. Do you think it would be wise if priests could live together, 3, 4, 5, 6, in a communal household of some sort?
Well, I mean, I've in my own heart and mind, I've kind of gone back and forth on that a number of times. Just that I think it's probably a lot of it is circumstantial and different situations warranted more than others.
Sure,
I do think that living together with other priests, or at least having a lot of exposure to the same priest, you know, is very important and very necessary to have true brotherhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
A real deep fraternity, which, as you said, I like the way you said it, sort of rubbing up against one. I mean, that you're, it's not just kind of getting together and pal around for dinner and then, you know, each taking off to his own rectory. I mean,
right.
There's something a little bit more substantial where you have the openness to fraternal correction, where you can identify things, you can, you know, and you ask for it and you give it. So I think that's essential, whether it happens by priests coming to live together or not. I think sometimes that might be a really good solution. On the other hand, I would also just say to, you know, a lot of folks, I think of, you know, St. Bernard once said about religious life, he said, all they see is the cross and not the consolation, you know. And there's so many beautiful things about being a priest. Our life is, if we're faithful, it's just filled with love. You
right.
know, we're around
right.
people all the time. And sometimes just being able to go back at night and having a quiet, you know, evening is just such a, you know, can be really needed, you know. And there's nothing lonely in that, right? I mean, the Lord is with you. And right, loneliness is more a state of mind than it is sort of circumstance, right?
Right.
I mean,
right. That's true.
You have a lot of loneliness in great crowds.
You can be alone, but not be lonely. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and especially a believer. You know, so I think there's a merit to it, but it, you know, maybe not in every case.
I'm curious about the instruction on celibacy, the helping young men determine if they mm-hmm. can live that promise. I talked to Father Benedict Rochelle many years ago. Actually, it was around 2002 because it was just after the crisis began.
Right.
And he and I were talking, and I knew that he had spent a lot of time working with priests and even those who had serious problems. But I asked him, so I'm curious, when you were in seminary, what kind of instruction did you have about celibacy and, you know, testing of it and all that? He said, nothing. We didn't do anything. We were just told, this is what you do. I was rather taken by that, and I'm sure that's not true today, right?
Not at all.
So, let us know how is it handled in the selecting of candidates and then monitoring it and testing and being pretty
right.
direct and straightforward about whether people are able to live it.
That's right. Yeah, no, I think, and it begins really with trying to be maybe better, wiser gatekeepers, you know, and like really making sure that the right guy who can discern this vocation is led into the seminary to begin with.
Yeah.
And that means somebody who has an appropriate level of maturity. I mean, you know, it's different from an 18-year-old and 25-year-old, but an appropriate level of maturity, a very clear masculine identity, a very clear sense of a love and a desire for marriage and fatherhood.
Right.
You know, a lot of people are surprised when I say that it actually rules out a candidate if he says he's not interested in marriage and family.
Yeah.
And they're like, I thought that's what you'd want. You
know? Yeah.
It's like, no. It's precisely the guy who can be a good husband and a good father who will also be a good priest. It's the same virtues. You know, it's the same virtues.
Yeah, no. Very good.
So if somebody's not ready for that, then I think that would be a case.
How do you, over a period of time, are you very direct in making sure that they are able to live a celibate life? Are you direct in saying, how are you doing with masturbation? How are you, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah, because, you know, in the culture in which these guys are coming from, the average age of being exposed to internet pornography right now is between 8 and 11 years old.
I know.
So, you know, which is, I mean, and it just completely messes with a young person's mind, you know? And
I know.
So many of them develop addictions and things like that. Now, we get obviously a much lower percentage of of those, you know, of that in the, you know, people coming into the seminary, but they're still affected, you know, by the culture at
sure.
large, and guys are still struggling with different things. And so we're very, very direct with them about those matters, and also just about, you know, some of the stuff we were talking about. Are you able to be alone and not be lonely?
Yeah.
You know? Are you able to kind of give yourself in these beautiful ways as a celibate person? So, yeah, there's a lot more formation today than there was in Benedict's time.
Father, thanks so much. Great talking with you. I hope we can call on you again.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Al.
Father Carter Griffin, it's a wonderful book called Why Celibacy? Reclaiming the Fatherhood of the Priest.
The EWTN home video highlight for July is The Chaplet of the Divine Mercy. This beautiful new rendition of the beloved devotional was shot on location at the National Shrine of the Divine Mercy in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Enjoy five versions of this invocation of trust in our Lord. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
We have a problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com, a nonprofit company.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
We know how much you love Ave Maria Radio, so please consider joining us in our Care to Share program. It's easy. We send you 10 business size cards that give you all the great ways that someone can listen to Ave Maria Radio, and you just give them away. Share them with those you love and those who would really benefit from our great programming. For more information, go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to find the Care to Share program link. That's AveMariaRadio.net, Community, and Care to Share.
Stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to
a
priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
We recently prevailed in a lawsuit filed in an Oklahoma federal court by Raja E. Fatia, a Muslim and a board member of CARE Oklahoma, against Chad and Nicole Neal, the owners of an Oklahoma gun range. Fatia was represented by lawyers from CARE, the ACLU, and a large New York law firm, the usual suspects. The American Freedom Law Center represented the Neals. The controversy arose when in 2015, Fatia entered the Neal's gun range armed with a loaded military-issue handgun strapped to his side, a military-style rifle slung over his shoulder, magazines loaded with approximately 140 rounds of 9mm ammunition, a concealed recording device in his pocket, and a dangerous agenda. To create a controversy with armed individuals at the gun range, hoping that he would not be allowed to fire his weapons so he could file this meritless lawsuit and run to the media with his prearranged Islamophobia narrative, knowing that the liberal media would willingly serve as an echo chamber for his spurious claim of discrimination. CARE's lawsuit was dismissed with prejudice. CARE's extremely reckless and dangerous attempt to set up a lawsuit to make a political point has failed. Apparently, CARE and the ACLU didn't want to put CARE's nefarious ties to terrorism on trial, so they caved in. And in the end, the good guys won yet again. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresto. With me, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, senior contributor to EWTN News and the National Catholic Register. Also a senior fellow at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Matthew, good to have you back.
Always good to be with you.
I understand you are out to the former Crystal Cathedral, which is now a Catholic cathedral.
Yes, Christ Cathedral. I had the distinct privilege, genuine privilege, of doing a bit of television coverage with Brian Patrick, as well as Father Robert Spitzer and Father Raymond D'Souza. So it was very interesting to see the dedication of a cathedral. We don't see that happen too often, and we see even more rarely, in fact, it's virtually unprecedented to have that type of a space, that type of a church converted, transformed into a Catholic, not just a Catholic church, but a Catholic cathedral.
Yeah. There's a wonderful history behind this. Robert Schuller, who was, I think, a Reformed Church of America pastor, was a real innovator in the world of what they call, in evangelical circles, they call church planting. And he originally was trying to reach people who were, quote, too busy to go to church. And he actually set up a church in a drive-in movie theater.
That's right. And one of the things I love in the Christ Cathedral, as it's now called, is that the parking lot still has all of the spots at a little angle because the flock would gather. And they could actually listen to him through the overflow from within the Crystal Cathedral, but it was set up like a drive-in.
Right, right. I mean, and he had enormous success. I think right now maybe people don't remember, but he had a number of best-selling books. And theologically, he was kind of in that tradition of Norman, in his pastoral work, he was kind of in the tradition of Norman Vincent Peale, Power of Positive Thinking. He had the power of possibility thinking and very big on self-esteem, kind of ironic because he was actually theologically a Calvinist. But the bottom fell out of the ministry at some point. I don't know when, but he ended up in bankruptcy.
Yes, and he had then this massive campus. I think it's 52 acres, right in the middle of Orange County. Now, one of the things that is remarkable to my mind is that he began the that ministry right there in Orange County in 1955, the same year as Disneyland was founded. And I'm not sort of saying that the Crystal Cathedral is to be compared to Disneyland,
right.
But it's a statement, I think, of his vision for the need to have this type of a cultural presence within the community.
Right.
At the very time when Orange County began growing rapidly, and one of the reasons that the Catholic Diocese of Orange wanted and considered purchasing what was his bankrupt property was because of the massive growth in Orange County. In the last 30 years, you have seen not just the diversity of the diocese increase, but the numbers. They're now looking at about 1.5 million Catholics in the Diocese of Orange. It is in its own right, basically, at least by population, the size of an archdiocese.
Yeah, yeah. When he built that cathedral, the Crystal Cathedral, it was enormously controversial among evangelical Protestants. Some of them thought he was a great innovator. Others thought that he was wantonly lavish in spending on his church. What were the circumstances? He's now passed on, but what were the circumstances that led to it becoming a Catholic property? We talked about this a few years ago, but
yes.
Listeners may be unaware of the story behind it.
Well, in 2011, the Schuller Ministries were effectively bankrupt. And this campus, again, imagine the size of this in the middle of Orange County.
Was it about 35 acres?
Yeah, I think about 52 acres.
52.
I mean, it's truly enormous, having spent a better part of a week there wandering around the campus and getting a feel for it. I've been there a couple of times during the transition. But it's big, and it not only had the Crystal Cathedral, which opened in 1980 at the time, the biggest glass structure in the world.
Okay.
And it had as well all these support buildings, including the Tower of Hope, where I would, in full disclosure, EWTN, Orange County Studios are based there. So we were actually broadcasting out of the Tower of Hope, which is on the campus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a tremendous property. There were a number of bidders, but the Reverend Schuller himself expressed his desire that this be given some, how we can say that he wanted the Catholic bid to be favored.
Yeah, that's right.
In large measure because he was hopeful that this would remain a place of faith within the community.
That's right.
And the way I've been describing the last few days is I wouldn't call him a friend of the church, but he was certainly friendly to
yes.
the church.
Yes.
And he said a couple of important things. One was that the Catholic Church, he said, will never change her theologies.
Mm-hmm.
And that stability, I think, was what he really desired,
right.
to have this continuity of faith in that location. So you're talking about not just the Crystal Cathedral, but you're also talking about this campus. So it served ideally for Orange, but it was still, and I've talked with several of the officials from the diocese, this was a big decision on the part of then Bishop Todd Brown to make a bid on this, but also to assume the immense task of transforming, converting this Crystal Cathedral, which really isn't crystal and was never a cathedral, into Christ Cathedral, which is perfectly named, but also a true cathedral.
And many people thought this was an impossible task from an architectural and design point of view to turn that structure into a Catholic cathedral, which would serve the liturgical purpose of the Catholic faith.
That's right. I mean, in fairness, it would be a lot less expensive to do this than it would be to start from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
As anyone who's been in charge of building cathedrals, I'm sure can tell us, it is an expensive proposition, especially in Southern California. Now, the project to begin a new cathedral was underway when this opportunity emerged. And so the diocese took the risk and made the bid. It was accepted, with the full support of Reverend Schuller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's that tie, though, that goes back to the church in this campus, in this Crystal Cathedral, and that is that the Reverend Schuller knew and actually was encouraged in his televangelism by Fulton J. Sheen.
Yeah, he loved Sheen.
He did.
Yeah, yeah.
He also had a direct connection with Pope John Paul II because he showed him the plans during a general audience in Rome.
I didn't know that. That's something
yeah.
I was unaware of. Okay.
Yeah. There's a photograph, in fact, that has been circulating the last few days showing him with John Paul II. And John Paul II, in his inimitable style, didn't so much bless the thing, but he certainly gave his approval to it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I spoke to Robert Schuller a few times over the years, and his theology was not one that I was especially warm to, but I always thought that he was an earnest and innovative fellow who was concerned with reaching people for Jesus. But the last time I talked to him was in California, maybe a year or so before his death. And at that time, he gave me the impression, anyways, that he was absolutely delighted with what the church was doing in coming in and developing the cathedral there.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine talked with him, again, I don't know if this is in print anywhere, but a friend of mine spoke with him quite a few years before. And he said that if he had any other religious affiliation, that he would be, it would be Catholic. So
yeah.
Take that, you know, who knows? But that's
well, he was a great respecter of tradition, certainly, at least as he understood it.
Right,
and I think
right.
part coming from the Reformed Church, I think they certainly are much closer to Calvin, who himself,
yeah.
of course, was, you could make the case, was closer than what we're certainly seeing today with most of mainline Protestants.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, so I'm just curious, how do you redesign glass? I
mean. Well, the one of the biggest tasks was figuring out a way to air condition the place because it, and my understanding is it never really had air conditioning.
Ooh.
And the glass, you're creating a greenhouse.
Yeah.
The amount of CO2 that must have been produced on a given summer must have been considerable. But that was just the start of the many challenges, because you have to create an appropriate liturgical space. You have to have all the elements of a cathedral, and they managed it with a diamond-shaped design for the interior. They've talked quite a bit about what are called these quadrifoil coverings for the windows, which take away a lot of the glare and the heat. Mm-hmm. It also cuts some of the light, because churches, certainly from our standpoint, we need to have that focus visually on the altar, on the Eucharist.
Yeah, and they would have had it on the pulpit, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they did was to bring in a massive crux gemata that overhangs the altar beneath a baldachin or a baldacchino. I know the technical term is a ciborium, and it really does set off very visually the altar, the crucifix, and the crux gemata is of a very stark medieval, early medieval design that we've all seen before. So there is a juxtaposition, I think, visually, but it's also, again, stressing the idea of continuity.
Yeah, yeah. Are they using it for liturgy now? Is it already being used?
Well, the dedication was yesterday, and a three-hour dedication, because of everything that's required in that. You had the incensation, but also the anointing of the altar and the walls. And then my favorite part, as you can imagine, was the deposition of the relics. So they had relics of St. John Paul II, of the North American martyrs, of Junipero Serra, several martyrs from the Mexican era of persecution under Plutarco Calles in the 1920s, and then a relic of Andrew Kim from Korea,
yeah.
And Andrew Dong Lac of Vietnam, a perfect embodiment of the authentically diverse, and I always have to stress that, authentically diverse community that exists within the Diocese of Orange. So you have Mass already being said in four languages. So this now becomes the parish of the cathedral. And they have been saying Mass already for some time in the facilities that they have on campus.
With a project like this, you can't please everybody.
That's right.
You know, has there been much criticism of it?
There has. On Twitter, I've certainly seen some criticism of, first, the idea of trying to convert the Crystal Cathedral into a Catholic cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, there's a long history of these types of conversions, of transformations of original buildings. I'm in no way comparing the Crystal Cathedral to a pagan temple, but we saw that with the Pantheon. We have seen that throughout church history.
Yeah.
So it is possible. And then there have been some critics about the specific liturgical space, but all of the elements of a cathedral are there. The cathedra, which of course is essential, that effectively makes a cathedral. This is now the seat of the Bishop of the Diocese of Orange, and it's there. And you have the altar, you have all of the other elements.
Yeah. Matthew, can you stay with us a little longer?
Yes, I can.
Okay. My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, taking a look at the remarkable transformation of the late Robert Schuller's Crystal Cathedral, a major development in American evangelical Protestantism of the last generation, now being transformed into a Catholic cathedral. I'm Al Cresta.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is Evidences for Christianity. Where do you get information about God? How can you be sure what you read or what you are told by authorities is true? For if the things we are told about Christianity are true, tremendous demands are put upon our lives. And to say we believe them requires that we live them. Elton Trueblood said,
"We should be foolish not to use all the intelligence we can muster in order to try to know whether Christianity is true. To fail to give our minds loyally to this inquiry would not be so much irreverent as stupid."
It's important, therefore, that we get and understand the facts, evidences, and reasons for Christianity. Our life here and for eternity depends on such efforts. To explore more, go to AveMariaRadio.net. Under Resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I discipline consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, That would mean I would discipline more, and I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B. That is why, when you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. We're going to continue conversation with Matthew on the other side of the news break next hour. And we'll be wrapping up the conversation about the Crystal Cathedral's transformation into the Catholic Cathedral, and also go and take a look at what's been going on in Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris. There's some reporting on the details about why the fire started. Apparently, it had been human error. 30 minutes went by before the fire was actually discovered, even though the fire alarm had been pulled. We'll talk about those details. And also the $1 billion that's been raised for the restoration of the cathedral. How is that being managed? And the French Parliament, what do they have to say about the restoration of Notre Dame Cathedral? Look, France has a very different attitude towards the church than the United States does. France has what I consider really an attitude of hostility towards religious institutions. They have a policy of laïcité, which is basically secularization of the public square. So we'll talk with Matthew about those things as well. Also next hour, Dr. Anthony Bradley looking at the problem of mass incarceration in the United States. Is it race? Is it poverty? Is it misbehavior? We'll find out. I'm Al Cresta.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thanking you for joining me. We're going to continue the conversation with Matthew Bunsen about the transformation of Robert Schuller's Crystal Cathedral into a Catholic cathedral. And then we'll also talk about some of the news coming out of Paris and the Cathedral of Notre Dame. Before we get back with Matthew, though, I do want to spend just a moment here. In the state of Michigan, where we broadcast from, in the last month, there have been news stories about the arrest of 6 priests. And we've pointed out before, but I'll do it again, because Bill Donahue from the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights has made a good point. All but one of those 6 cases were, in fact, very old cases. 2 from more than 20 years ago, 2 from more than 30 years ago, and 1 from the 1970s, more than 40 years ago. And the only case that's more current did not involve a minor. Now, in comparison, in just in 2019 in the state of Michigan, at New Haven High School, the male coach of the girls' basketball team was recently charged with engaging in improper relations with a 17-year-old. In January, it was revealed that a male teacher at Whittemore Prescott area schools admitted to abusing 15 boys. He then committed suicide. Also, a former female Rochester High School teacher was charged in January on 6 counts of third-degree criminal sexual misconduct. A male teacher at KEC Oakley, Grand Rapids Public School, was charged in January with possession of child porn and using a computer to commit a crime. He sought to have relations with a 13-year-old girl. I could go down. There's more. I bring this up not because I'm delighting in misbehavior in the public schools. I bring it up, though, to say that a lot of the reporting on what's been happening in the Catholic Church is greatly distorted because similar reporting is not going on about other institutions, public institutions in particular. All right, stay with me. We'll pick up with Matthew in just a few minutes, and also Dr. Anthony Bradley on mass incarceration in the U.S., but let's get to the headlines first.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, July 18th. It's the Feast of St. Camillus of Lellis. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. House Democrats are bringing a bill to the House floor to raise the federal minimum wage to $15.
This bill honors the dignity of work, grows the economy, and upholds the bedrock idea of fairness in our country, that hard work deserves a decent wage.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying it will give millions of American women a raise. The legislation would increase the national minimum pay rate per hour over the course of the next 5 years. The current minimum wage is $7.25, which hasn't changed since 2009. President Trump is disavowing chance of send her back. White House Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley says the president tried to stop the chanters quickly.
He didn't let the chant go on very long. He was very stoic, and he kept on driving his message home. He didn't let the crowd slow him down all that long.
Trump says he disagrees with the sentiment that was expressed by the crowd at his rally in North Carolina last night. The chants were directed at Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar after he sharply criticized the lawmaker. Trump said the chants started up quickly and noted that he moved on with his speech as soon as possible. The Democratic National Committee is sending a security alert to 2020 presidential campaigns, warning them not to use FaceApp. The popular smartphone app has been trending lately as celebrities have been using it to post images of themselves appearing older. The DNC security chief sent an alert saying FaceApp was developed by Russians and that they have significant concerns about the app having access to your photos. And Delta Airlines will soon have doses of Narcan included in the emergency medical kits on its aircraft. The emergency medication used to reverse opioid overdoses have already been added at United, Frontier, and Alaska Airlines. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria, Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being with me. My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and I have been talking about something you don't see very often, and that is the taking over of a large evangelical Protestant work of architecture, Robert Schuller's Crystal Cathedral, which itself was very controversial among American conservative Protestants last generation, but taking that remarkable structure and turning it into a Catholic cathedral, so with all of the criteria for proper liturgical design, I mean, it's a real task. Melanie, do you know how much it cost?
I believe that the overall construction project was about $71
million. Okay.
Again, as cathedrals go, fairly economical.
Yeah, that's not, I mean, that's a lot of money, but it's not, right. You can spend a whole lot more than that on starting from scratch.
Especially knowing that it required, I think the estimate was thousands and thousands of feet of scaffolding just to install the quadrifoil coverings for the ceiling, as well as all of the marble and everything else. And let's also remember that building anything in Southern California is an expensive proposition.
Right, right. I'm curious, in the past, large worship spaces like this, Protestant worship spaces, if they're mainline Protestant, almost always have a focus on the pipe organ. I would assume that the Schuller did the same thing with the Crystal Cathedral.
He did. It was the very famous Hazel Wright organ, named after the very beneficent woman who donated a substantial amount of money to pay for an organ.
Wow.
And Interestingly enough, Bishop Van, I believe, plays the organ, so he has actually tested out the organ,
wow.
as does the rector of the Christ Cathedral, and that's Father Christopher Smith.
Oh, nice.
So both of them have been able to play the organ.
Does it grab the eye like it used to?
It does, except it. I think it's blended a bit more into the overall design, so it doesn't leap out at you. The main visual elements as you walk into the cathedral, straight in front of you is the altar, the Crux Gemata that I was mentioning. There is a pantocrator to the right. Along the back wall is a mosaic of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And then on either end, if you're thinking of a diamond shape, at the points, the long elongated points, on the one side we have the baptismal font, and then on the other we have the Eucharistic chapel.
Wow. There's a lot of acreage there. How much of it, are there other functions to the building?
Well, the cathedral itself is now very dedicated to its function as a cathedral, but the campus itself has, as I was mentioning, the Tower of Hope, where you have a number of apostolates and other missions present. But then you also have on the campus, there's an academy, there are also the diocesan pastoral center. So they're maximizing, I think, the use of all of the purchase of this campus. And then there's also going to be a shrine to Our Lady of Vietnam. At some point in the future, there's going to be a columbarium, there will be a crypt, as well as a functioning cultural center right now, which is bringing in a lot of exhibits. Right now, I think they're looking at the Sistine Chapel. So one of those traditional roles of a cathedral, and this brings us in a way to Notre Dame, is to be a center of life in any community. Mm-hmm. Not only is it the center of life for the Catholic community, for a diocese of a particular church, is the seat of the bishop, is the seat of his authority, cathedrals historically have been places of learning, of community life, of civic activity. And one of the things that struck me about this campus, inheriting the position it already had from the Schuller Ministries, is that it is clearly embedded and a part of the community of Orange County and of Southern California.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I'm anxious to see how this, over the years, how this wears. And I'm glad that it's been dedicated. I'm anxious to see it sometime myself.
I'd recommend it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even in the time that I was out there, a lot of tourists, you heard a lot of different languages of people who were visiting Southern California who wanted to see it, but who also were looking for a place to go for mass. Yeah, I mean, it speaks well of the tourists.
Right.
But
one other
point that struck me is that in California right now, we have this new Christ Cathedral. We have the unusual, the remarkable architectural design of the L.A. Cathedral. And we have the Cathedral of Light up in Oakland. Those are the three newest in recent memory for California, and all of them are what one could certainly call avant-garde, very forward-looking architecture.
Yeah.
And with varying opinions about how they're going.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, we'll find out if in 25 years they still look forward-looking.
Yes, right. Well, I mean, here we are talking about it. The Crystal Cathedral was built in 1980, and it opened in 1980, and it still is oddly forward-looking.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Let's shift gears here. New York Times recently had a report suggesting that the Notre Dame Cathedral came very close to completely collapsing, and the French Parliament has now passed a bill on rebuilding Notre Dame. It's about 3 months ago that the fire happened.
Yes.
What do you know about first of all, was there any controversy about the bill on rebuilding Notre Dame?
Controversy in the sense of, I think there was genuine relief.
Yeah. Okay.
Right from the start of the fire, one of the biggest complaints was that when President Emmanuel Macron of France said that he wanted to open this process up to bold and innovative ideas.
Right.
And various people made proposals. It's been on social media. Someone had the idea of a pool on the top to replace the spire. Someone actually suggested that they do a minaret to commemorate French evils of colonialism in Algeria. Although the symbolism, I don't think, would have had much to do at all with Algeria. We've had various types of glass spires. We've had somebody wanted a garden up there. So the French Parliament, the National Assembly, in approving this reconstruction bill, is really mandating to restore it to it as close as we can to what it was at the time of the fire.
Okay, good.
And that's a real blessing, I think. And it's something that the Archbishop of Paris, Michel Aupetit, has been saying from the very beginning, that we cannot lose focus of what is the purpose of a cathedral.
Right.
What is the purpose of this church? And that is to be a place where we find Christ in the Eucharist.
Do they expect the work to be done before the Paris's hosting of the Olympics in 2024?
Well, that's one of the other controversial aspects of this, because Macron has been pushing very hard that this be done in 5 years. We now know, in part thanks to the New York Times investigation and the ongoing examination of just how severe the damage was, that if it was in fact close to collapsing, and where the fear was of the two magnificent bell towers, had those gone, Notre Dame would effectively be gone as well. And now we don't know as yet, according to reports, how long that sort of restoration is going to take before they can even begin thinking about restoring the grandeur of Notre Dame itself. We have elements of getting all of the rubble out, and there's fear now of lead poisoning because of the lead that was used in the roof and the elements throughout the cathedral, as well as just the toxic problems created by the fire. So there's an immense amount of work to go just to shoring up the cathedral before we even get to rebuilding it in a way that does great homage to its founders.
Wow. I'm wondering, France has a very funny attitude towards public expressions of religion. It's a far more secular in its law than we are here in the United States. Not nearly as friendly a relationship between church and state. But how are they handling the state's involvement in the overseeing of this project?
Well, you're absolutely right, Al, that the secular arm is very much present in French political life and cultural life. So much so that the process in French is called laïcité.
Yeah.
And it's basically the laicization or secularization. There is a law in 1905 that took control of the French government of every church built before that year. And that, of course, includes Notre Dame. Now, the church is granted in perpetuity the right to control Notre Dame, but that means it's also responsible for the upkeep and paying the salaries and other things. So the one complication that we're looking at is the near $1 billion that has been raised to help restore it. And part of the back and forth now, the complexity is going to be who's going to oversee the distribution of the funds, because the French government has its say. The church certainly has a vested interest in this. But there seems to be growing consensus, universal agreement almost, that whatever we do with these funds, let's get the cathedral back to what it was, what was described by Emmanuel Macron as the heart of the French nation.
Yeah, interesting. At least the end result seems to be clear. They want restoration, not innovation. And do you know who controls that $1 billion right now?
Well, right now, most of it is controlled by the government.
Okay.
But it's coming in from donations from individuals, from corporations. You have private donors. I think several hundred million euro were pledged, I think, by the son of the owners of Christie's. I think it's Bernard Arnault and François-Henri Pinault.
Okay.
So they between them, I think they've pledged almost 300 million euro.
Oh, really? Wow. That's quite a
So that the great families of France really did step up. But then there are the contributions from literally all over the world.
I'm sure.
That were pouring in. Yeah. To the point that the Archbishop of Paris, Archbishop Aupetit, had to say, we have to be careful about where you're sending your money.
Because
scammers are already out there.
That's right. There was also, in the Times report, there was writing of a miscommunication between a security guard and an employee monitoring the building's fire alarm. It meant the fire wasn't discovered until it had already been burning 30 minutes.
That's right. Based on the reporting of the Times, this is classic human error, that you had a rookie guard who first either was sent or went to the wrong building when the fire alarm went off. He actually, I think, wandered over to the sacristy, didn't see anything.
Oh.
And it created enough of a delay that by the time they actually spotted the fire, it was far too large simply to put out with a fire extinguisher. one can derive a certain comfort that this happened because of human error and that the investigation has not turned up, that there was real malice behind this.
Right, right.
But it's a demonstration, too, of the fragility of a cathedral, but how genuinely remarkable it is that it survived as long as it did without something major like this happening, especially that disasters like this have been striking cathedrals and major churches over the centuries
right.
on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah, yeah. Have they started Mass there yet?
Just a few weeks ago, Archbishop Opetit said Mass in the cathedral. He had to wear a hard hat during it. But Mass is back in Notre Dame, and
okay.
Let's pray that it stays there.
All right. Matthew, thanks so much. How do people stay in touch with you?
You can find me at EWTNnews.com.
All right. And be listening again for Register Radio, Saturdays 7 in the evening, Sundays at 11 in the morning. We'll talk again, Matthew. Thanks.
God bless.
We recently won an important case in federal court in Toledo, Ohio. For too long, city police officers were enforcing local and state laws to prohibit pro-lifers from engaging in free speech activity on the public sidewalks outside of a local abortion center. In our case, the court issued an order prohibiting the city and its police officers from enforcing any local or state law as applied to the expressive activity of pro-life demonstrators, including our clients. This is yet another victory for the First Amendment in a case where a city and its police officers were abusing their authority to silence peaceful pro-life demonstrators to appease those engaged in the baby-killing business. As the court's order demonstrates, the Constitution protects our clients' pro-life activity from such abuse. The government has no authority to silence our clients' speech simply because they are preaching the gospel on a public sidewalk next to an abortion center. Indeed, this victory is yet another blow to the abortion industry, which has too often relied on the government to promote and support its bloody business by silencing those who oppose it. The actions of the city of Toledo and its officers in this case were deplorable, and they violated our clients' fundamental rights. We stop this egregious activity in Toledo, and we intend to stop it wherever it raises its ugly head. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
We know how much you love Ave Maria Radio, so please consider joining us in our Care to Share program. It's easy. We send you 10 business size cards that give you all the great ways that someone can listen to Ave Maria Radio, and you just give them away. Share them with those you love and those who would really benefit from our great programming. For more information, go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to find the Care to Share program link. That's AveMariaRadio.net, Community, and Care to Share.
Does the fourth commandment only order us to honor our father and our mother? According to the Catholic Catechism, it also obliges us to give honor and respect to all whom for our good God has vested with his authority. Respecting the fourth commandment, says the Catechism, brings its own reward, not only with spiritual fruits, but temporal benefits of peace and prosperity. Whereas failure to observe the commandment brings harm to individuals and communities. We are reminded that marriage and the family is ordered to the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of children. The Catechism states a man and a woman united in marriage together with their children is what forms a family. God instituted the human family when he created man and woman and instructed them to increase and multiply. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John, chapter 8, verse 51. Jesus is in a discussion with some of the leaders of the Jews. They're talking about Abraham. Abraham lived 1,500 years before the time of Jesus. So in the course of the discussion, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." He says that often in the Gospels. "He who keeps my word or believes in me will never die." To which the Jews say, "Now we know you have a demon." And they say, "Abraham died, as did the prophets. All the patriarchs, the great men and women of the history of Israel. All these people died, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets, who died?" And Jesus says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad." To which the Jews say, "You are not yet 50 years old, and you've seen Abraham?" And Jesus answers, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am."
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Mass incarceration is an overwhelming problem in the United States. Reforms are very difficult, and that leads to a lot of confusion, you know, about, well, why is the United States a champion of individual liberty? Why do we incarcerate such a large percentage of our population? Now, this is a question that conservatives bring up, liberals bring up, progressives bring up. It's a baffling question. In fact, former Vice President Joe Biden, now presidential candidate Biden, was challenged to support an ACLU plan to cut incarceration by 50%. And this is what he said.
My name is Keith Albert. I'm an ACLU Rights for All voter. The ACLU.
I'm an ACL member, too, and rated about 100% throughout the whole year.
That's awesome. So you're familiar with our program. The ACLU has a roadmap for cutting incarceration by 50% through reforms that have been endorsed by both the right and the left, including four other presidential candidates and many conservatives.
Let me show you.
Do you commit to cutting incarceration by 50% if elected?
We can do it more than that. There should be no. Look, get his name. I'll send you exactly what my program is.
Is it a yes or no?
Yeah, the answer is yes.
Thank you.
But I got a better plan than you guys have.
I can't wait to hear it.
Well, there you have presidential candidate Joe Biden saying he has a better plan than cutting incarceration by 50%. With me right now to talk about the problem and help us get a handle on how to even begin thinking clearly and Christianly about it is Dr. Anthony Bradley. He's Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the King's College in New York City, where he serves as Director for the Center for the Study of Human Flourishing. He's also a Research Fellow at Acton Institute, and he's the author of Ending Overcriminalization and Mass Incarceration. Anthony, good to have you back with me. Thanks.
Happy to be here.
Let's talk about this. It must have been a year and a half ago that I read a book by Michelle Crow, which made the case that the reason we have so many blacks incarcerated is that America is so overwhelmingly racist that black Americans, those who are arrested, are not able to get justice, and that they are overly harshly sentenced when they do appear before the bench. What is the reason so many black Americans are in prison?
Well, that's quite a complicated question.
I think the
lazy solution or answer to the question is to assume there's some sort of race-based agenda by people in power to incarcerate specifically African Americans. I think what we find more directly when you look at the decline of criminal law over the last century or so is that we tend to be overly punitive with poor people, and that has historical precedent, unfortunately. And in urban areas, poor people tend to be black.
Right.
In the current era. In the 1930s and 40s in urban areas, poor people were immigrants from Germany or Poland or Ireland. We were overly punitive with them as well. I think in this historical moment, since the 1970s, we've just been overly punitive toward poor people in inner cities, and so we've seen that spike since. We can talk about this later, but the numbers of blacks that have been incarcerated have actually been rapidly declining since about the mid-2000s.
Is that in actual numbers or in percentage?
That's in actual numbers, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Was there a time when poor whites were overly harshly sentenced?
Yes. In fact, that time is actually now.
Okay.
When you look at the rates of increase of rural incarceration, predominantly rural whites, over the last three decades or so, incarceration rates have gone up 425%. And so right now, there's actually an incarceration spike with rural communities, particularly working class and lower class whites in this country. Now, we also had high rates of punitive behavior toward lower class whites when they lived in urban areas prior to World War, well, I'd say prior to the Korean War, we began to see shifts of former white immigrants who lived in urban areas to move in the 1950s. And basically, wherever poor people are, we've had overly punitive police presence and incarceration.
So the story of harsh sentencing has more to do with class and economics than it has to do with race?
Exactly. That's something I've been arguing, is that when we look at the way in which we write criminal law, prosecute criminal law, essentially, if you're a poor person, you're much more likely to end up in the criminal justice system than if you are a middle-class person or higher, and that's really irrespective of race. So parents of middle-class kids who are black get their kids out of trouble with expensive lawyers. The same thing for Asians and whites and Hispanics as well. The white underclass, the Hispanic underclass, the black underclass is much more likely to be taken advantage of by prosecutors because they don't have the sorts of defense that they need to properly defend their case against. What we see in many jurisdictions is prosecutors who are overly punitive and abuse their power.
Okay, so the biblical emphasis on the poor really would then play into this. The concern for the poor is not just that they get food, but that they also get proper justice in the courts.
Absolutely. And even to press the case further, I mean, we have constitutional amendments that require, speedy trials, right? You have to have warrants in order to enter people's properties and things like that. And those sorts of rules often get violated because people in lower classes don't know the law and can't defend themselves.
Right.
They often agree to things out of ignorance.
Right.
And they're taken advantage of by people who know more. That's less likely to happen in middle class and higher class communities. And because of the role of the prosecutor, which is basically the only actor in the criminal justice system without real accountability, the poor are really vulnerable to prosecutorial abuse. And that's
right.
Where we begin to see a major funnel was with prosecutors being overly punitive of people who were at the mercy of the courts and the public defender system.
Wow. So when we look, I mean, is it true that America is incarcerates a larger percentage of its population than any other developing country or developed country?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at per capita, what you find is that we are overly punitive in ways that other countries are not. And basically, that should be understood in two ways. One is that we tend to choose punishment as a way to deal with people that we're angry at.
Hmm.
We often don't have other opportunities for diversion to deal with people who take advantage of the social contract and break it. Our default is to punish. In other places, the default might be something else. But in America, since the early 18th century, our default position has been to punish first. Now, secondly, it's important to understand that in a lot of other countries, one of the reasons they don't lock people up is they just kill them.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so when we're compared to me, it's extraordinary that we would be compared to like Russia or China, right? As if the criminal justice apparatus in Putin's Russia and in China or in Venezuela or Cuba is actually comparable to ours at the outset.
That's
and
right.
So you can do a one-to-one comparison with us and Russia. I can't believe that America imprisons more people than the Chinese government. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? I can't, people compare us to North Korea. We imprison more people than North Koreans. Of course we do, because in those countries they just kill people.
That's terrible, but it is in its own way. It's funny. Yeah, I know. But it is the indignation. So the indignation it floors me.
Right. So here's what actually matters. Here's what really matters. Do we have to throw people in jail every time they break a law? That's really the central question. Or are there alternatives for punishment that don't require incarceration?
Right.
And that's where the new imagination for criminal justice reform is moving, in terms of thinking about who do we need to put in jail and who can we simply put on probation or on parole or things like that. And that's really what we're moving to in the future.
Is there any easy way to get at this? I mean, do we say something like, well, we only incarcerate violent offenders, and nonviolent offenders, we work out some other system, restitution or community service or something? Is there an easy dividing line?
That's a fantastic intuition. So you're headed in the right direction. We're beginning to rethink whether or not we need to put someone in jail because they fail to pay their parking fine.
Right.
I mean, we have a problem in the U.S. that we, in order to motivate behavior, we make things illegal. And we've increasingly made more things illegal. We've added to the criminal code. There are almost 5,000 laws in the criminal code in this country that you can be arrested for. And that just builds. And so we're thinking about it in terms of public safety. And who do we need to remove from society in order to keep the public safe?
Right.
And it seems to me that people who commit misdemeanors or people who commit, say, white-collar sorts of crime may not be a threat to public safety. However, violent offenders clearly are. Sexual offenders clearly are.
Mm-hmm.
People who commit property crimes clearly are. And so the conversation now is really, what do we do with violence? Because that's really primarily why people are incarcerated in the first place. It's violence and property crime that really determines the mass, a population of people who are in prison.
Okay.
And so what's happened over the last few years is that we've refined the areas that we need to actually address.
Can you stay with me a few more minutes, Anthony?
Absolutely.
Okay. My guest, Dr. Anthony Bradley, he's the author of Ending Overcriminalization and Mass Incarceration, Hope from Civil Society. I'm Al Cresta.
When I was outside of the church, there was always an unsettled feeling. There was always a feeling of something missing and something not complete. The deal clincher is we found our way to our parish. And we met just an incredible pastor. We learned things that we had never been taught. Wouldn't be the person that I am without the church and without the sacraments, particularly the Eucharist. I can't live without it.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999. This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company, and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Everyday living. Effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Ave Maria Radio is having a Christmas in July sale going on right now at AveMariaRadio.net. Deck your halls with great books, talks, and other products for friends, family, and even for yourself. Products featuring Father John Ricardo are on sale, including a 20% discount on all single show copies of Christ is the Answer. Just apply the promo code CIAJULY19 at checkout. Don't miss out on Ave Maria Radio's Christmas in July sale, going on right now at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
The EWTN home video highlight for July is the Chaplet of the Divine Mercy. This beautiful new rendition of the beloved devotional was shot on location at the National Shrine of the Divine Mercy in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Enjoy five versions of this invocation of trust in our Lord. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs in community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Anthony Bradley, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the King's College in New York City, where he also serves as Director for the Center for the Study of Human Flourishing. He's a research fellow at the Acton Institute and author of Ending Overcriminalization and Mass Incarceration, Hope from Civil Society, published by Cambridge University Press. We were talking before the break about criteria for what kind of crimes merit jail, imprisonment. So, Anthony, you were saying, so there is, I mean, this is a, is this a fruitful area for American social policy now? Is this, is it got momentum? Are people really thinking this through? Are we on the verge of some real changes?
We are. I mean, we've actually seen a significant decline in overall incarceration rates nationally because states are beginning to rethink the criteria for people in jail and prison. It's important, I think, for people to understand that almost 90% of prisoners are in state prisons and not federal prisons. Now, what that means is that state law is what really matters, and that individual states are beginning to change their statutes so that it has the effect of simply of reducing the number of people that enter into the system in the first place. So we've had real significant declines. I mean, when I first was looking at this, there were about 2.3 million or so people in the system. As of 2018, according to very good data from the Vera Institute, we're down to 1.4 million, about 1.5 million.
Wow.
And that's a 1.3% decline in 2017. So the overall slope is actually down, and that's been great news. And that's because individual states are making adjustments and repealing some statutes that give judges more discretion, that really control prosecutors' freedoms to stack charges and be overly punitive. But also, there are really good interventions being introduced that keep you out of the system in the first place. And then lastly, we're getting to see more divergent programs that are allowing people to pursue other forms of punishment other than jail or prison.
Do you know why it is that the United States tended to resort to imprisonment when other nations didn't? I mean, certainly in America's formation, Protestant Christianity, with its emphasis on Scripture, was a major formative influence. Scripture doesn't have a big role for prisons, does it?
Well, if you think about the word penitentiary, and part of the root of that word is actually repentance.
Right, right.
And our current prison system was actually started by the Quakers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so Christians invented the penitentiary system as a way to bring people out of community when they violated the moral code, keep them incarcerated until they would repent, and then be released back into community.
Mm-hmm.
So in this country, in terms of the ways in which particular colonies were settled as religious colonies, that when you broke the moral code, you were properly punished until you repented. And that's what punishment was actually initially designed to do, was to encourage repentance.
So it wasn't purely retribution then?
It was not at all. There was some retributive aspects, but primarily it was to motivate repentance. Mm-hmm. So that people would want to be released and choose a different path forward. And as the sort of Christian roots of punishment were dissolved from the system, and we adopted the English system of our prison system, you know, the first major prison in Philadelphia is designed exactly off some of the ones in England. And so as it evolved away from the sort of Christian foundations, we use the system as a way to control poor people and manage the poor. And that coincided with our inability to control criminalizing literally, it seems to be everything under the sun. When we want to motivate behavior, we just make it a crime.
Yeah, yeah. So with this new thinking about incarceration, where are the, when I hear a conversation about this, race still plays an enormous role in the public debate. I mentioned Michelle Alexander earlier in her book, The New Jim Crow, which sees incarceration as a tool of a racist society. That is still a powerful narrative out there. Is it relinquishing its strength? I mean, her book has had a lot of influence, I think.
Sure. Her book is basically canonized in this discussion.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I think because it includes class, I think that what we assume is racial is actually more, can be more accurately attributed to class.
Right.
The problem, as I mentioned earlier, is that this is largely a geographic problem, right? You don't have a lot of poor blacks in rural Montana, Idaho, South Dakota,
right.
Indiana. You just don't have that.
Right.
Okay? So when you look on the surface, it appears as if the criminal justice system is targeting lower class blacks. Now, I don't want to overstate the case and say that race is not a factor.
Okay.
Right? It's a factor because people are in particular geographies, and it exacerbates the existing problem of us being overly punitive in the West in general toward the poor.
Mm-hmm.
We do not like poor people. Mm-hmm. We don't, and it doesn't matter if they're living in a housing project in inner city or Chicago, or if they're living in a trailer park in West Virginia, Indiana, or Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like them. And we use the criminal justice system to manage and control poor people. Now, the media also has a role to play in positioning the story to be targeted toward the cities, because it's easier to tell that story.
Yeah.
I live in New York. If they want to tell a story about crime and police, it takes about 3 minutes. You just drive down the street.
Yeah.
If you're in some rural area, it's not immediately available. So the media has also has a role to play in portraying crime as something that's sort of black and urban,
mm-hmm.
when actually it's not.
Interesting.
Right?
Interesting.
Movies and television shows, et cetera, locate crime and law enforcement in the last 50 years in urban areas.
Right.
When that really hasn't been simply the case. And we have to expand our, not imagination, we have to expand the truth about where crime's happening and where police and prosecutors are being overly punitive. But race most certainly does play a factor in how some police departments chose to target particular neighborhoods, and particularly in inner cities.
Mm-hmm.
So they definitely would go to certain predominantly black neighborhoods because you had concentrations of people committing property crime, violent crime, and drug crime. And it's actually cheaper and more efficient to arrest people in highly dense areas than it is in rural areas.
Right,
so it would make more sense than in terms of some of those metrics that the numbers would be higher. Now, Michelle Alexander primarily focused on the federal system and not the state system, which is different. I think listeners also would be important to read another book by James Forman Jr. called Locking Up Our Own, where he tells the story of cities like Atlanta and Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia that were run almost exclusively by all African-American administrations, right? Black mayor, black police department,
right.
Black prosecutors,
yeah.
Black judges, and you still had high rates of incarceration of African-Americans in low-income communities.
Right.
Why is
right.
that? Because the black middle class is just as punitive as the white middle class.
Yes, okay.
Why is that?
Yep.
Because nobody likes poor people. That's the problem. And until we begin to have more affection, love, care, concern for the poor, we will struggle to manage how the prosecutors and how the system adjudicates them into jail and prison.
Wow. Now, that is a fascinating reversal of expectations. I think that this forces us back into, again, the emphasis on concern for the poor, which was evident in St. Paul's ministry, is evident on the pages of the Old Testament, and it's supposed to be a mark of the Christian community. That's fascinating. Is our dislike for the poor fear? I mean, why is that? What do you make of that?
It's something, as you read in the Gospels, as you read in the New Testament. I mean, this has been go back to the Pentateuch as well. This has been a constant struggle
yeah.
for people,
yeah.
for God's people, right? To care for people who are on the margins. This has been, I think we have a natural inclination toward those who are wealthy and powerful.
Sure.
And we seem to have a natural contempt for people who are below us on the social ladder.
Yeah.
Now, this is how I stumble into this whole thing, is that I noticed in the data that if you look at the juvenile system and if you look at the adult system, especially for men, what do you find? You find primarily boys and men who come from broken families in poor communities. So here's what you don't find. You don't find the juvenile system populated by boys who come from two-parent families.
Right, right.
You don't find that.
Yeah.
You just don't find that, right?
So there's linkage between family structure and poverty.
Absolutely, absolutely. So here's what happened. You have a poor kid who's 6 or 7 years old. He sees his mom get beat up by her boyfriend. Dad's out of the picture. When he becomes 13, 14, he starts to act out from that past trauma, and then he gets arrested because he broke a window, he mugged somebody, stole something out of a store, right?
Yep.
And once he enters the system, he's criminalized
yep.
in jail
yep.
because it makes it worse off. Then he gets out a year or two later, and because he's criminalized, he commits more crime, and now he's 23, and he's in it for 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so what I noticed in the data, Al, is that we're not just locking up bad kids, right? We're locking up hurt kids. We're locking up broken kids. We're locking up kids that did not have the level of love, care, connection, inspiration, education, community involvement that middle-class kids do that tend to result in them going in different directions.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so until we begin to support and love and care for the poor, we're not going to see the types of reductions in the levels of incarceration that Joe Biden was talking about in that clip.
Yeah, yeah. Well, excellent, Anthony. Thanks so much. We'll talk again, because this is a topic that is of special interest to me. I've had family members in the criminal justice system imprisoned, and I also lived in a lower socioeconomic area of Detroit for 10 years, so it's something that's on my mind. So we'll talk soon. Thank you.
You're welcome. Happy to be on the show again.
Dr. Anthony Bradley is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the King's College in New York. His book, Ending Overcriminalization and Mass Incarceration. I'm Al Cresta.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
To vent or not? If I get it off my chest, then I feel better. I gotta vent. Is this so? It's old theory. Somewhat like a catharsis. You've got to purge yourself of these emotions, and Lord help anyone who's standing in the way. It's old theory. It's inaccurate. Venting is generally not good for the hearers, and it's not good for the venter. Venting may be good for dryers. It's not good for people. When we vent, we become more likely to vent. And when we are more likely to vent, we are more likely to hurt and say things we shouldn't say. Careful on the venting. Better to think about what you have to say before you vent.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
John 6, verses 48 to 58. Jesus says, I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, and they died. This is the bread, meaning me. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that a man may eat of it and never die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh. At which the Jews disputed among themselves, saying, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? They're scandalized by this. How is it that we're not? How is it that we just hear this and go, oh yeah, I know that passage? They're just outraged and at least perplexed. Sane people, inspired teachers, wise men, prophets don't say things like this.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Do follow through on the topics that we discussed today, reclaiming priestly celibacy and why celibacy, the book by Father Carter Griffin, available in the online bookstore. Anthony Bradley's book on overcriminalization, available also in the online bookstore. And we'll have plenty of articles following up on those topics. And, of course, my conversation about Notre Dame Cathedral and also the Crystal Cathedral in Orange County, California. We'll have follow-up information at the Cresta Guest Archive. So just head on over there, AveMariaRadio.net. Again, that's AveMariaRadio.net. We'll also include the Catholic League report comparing what's been happening in Michigan churches with what's going on in Michigan schools regarding sexual misconduct. So again, just follow up by going to AveMariaRadio.net. Tomorrow on Cresta in the Afternoon, we'll be taking a look at the change in leadership at Planned Parenthood. I'm Al Cresta.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.